Hey, In the Thick listeners. Just a note that since we recorded today's show, some news broke. Kamala Harris has dropped out of the 2020 race, and the House Democrats have laid out their official case for impeachment. Okay, so it looks like we have a lot to talk about at our Friday ITT sound off. But in the meantime, we break down other stories related to the 2020 election and the impeachment in this roundtable. So enjoy.
We literally got to see this as serious about not just saving democracy, but literally making this a safe environment to save our own lives. Uno, dos, tres. Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome back to the world after Thanksgiving. It's In the Thick. This is a podcast about politics, race, and culture from a POC perspective. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and I survived the holiday. How are you?
I'm Julio Ricardo Varela, and I'm very thankful that I survived the holidays.
Yeah, you were working hard. Listen, we're so happy to have in our Harlem studio Esther Wang. She's a senior staff writer with Jezebel. Hey, Esther, welcome back.
Hi, thank you so much for having me again.
And joining us from the podcast garage in Boston, along with our dear Julio, is Latasha Brown. She's co-founder of Black Voters Matter, and she's a 2019 Harvard IOP Fellow. Welcome back to the show, Latasha.
Oh, I'm happy to be here, and I'm very full today.
Yeah, aren't we all? All right, okay, listen, so there's a lot of fullness going around in terms of the conversation around electoral politics. It feels so robust. Tight at the belt, if you will.
Wow, nice.
And fullness would be a word that we'll just throw to Pete Buttigieg. Because, wow, I mean, new polls, and it's like all people want to talk about is Mayor Pete Buttigieg. Now, he is surging in Iowa, and that's very, very interesting. I find that very interesting. Also in New Hampshire. But he is really struggling to get Black and Latino voter support. He's polling at 1% of Latino support in Nevada, which is a kind of important state. That's according to a Fox News poll. Buttigieg is literally polling at 0% in terms of Black support in South Carolina. That's according to a recent Quinnipiac University poll.
Wow.
So, you know, when we interviewed him for Latino USA, he seemed to basically say,
the people who are most afraid of immigrants don't know any. So through a mixture of cruelty and incompetence, we have these images coming from the border now of these horrible detention conditions. But even they are useful in some ways to the administration, especially they actually know what image they're presenting. And it's an image that's designed to evoke and arouse various emotions among people. If we actually resolve that human crisis, even if it's an imperfect and temporary fix while we're dealing with the bigger picture, I think it allows us to get to a different temperature in the conversation that helps others who have resisted humane immigration policy realize that nothing is being taken from you. This is not at your expense.
But specifically with Black voters, there have been some problems with community support there. So, Latasha, back in October, during our live show from Cambridge, you told us that this isn't about the candidates, that instead it's about the voters. And you said it's voters who push candidates to be more progressive. And in this case, with Buttigieg, we know that, unlike candidates like Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, he's a moderate.
Yeah.
So, right. Latasha, what's going on for you as you're watching all of this? You know, yes, he did spend this past weekend in North Carolina with Reverend Barber.
We can't ignore the South any longer. We can't write off the South. One third of all the poor people in this nation live in the South. One third of all white people that are poor live in the South. And as Dr. King said, there have been systematic attempts to separate Black and white and brown and Native people in the South, because particularly poor and well, who have the potential to reset the political calculus in this nation.
But he was like, yo, man, people have been asking and talking about this for months. So if I was feeling that way, Latasha, how are you feeling?
You know, it's so amazing. I think there are three big points on this. One of them, part of it, I don't know if I blame Pete Buttigieg or not. Like, the media is just damn near just hell-bent on forcing this narrative that we have to have the white male savior to get us away from Trump, right? And so I think what we're seeing now in this Pete Buttigieg kind of frenzy, It's Iowa, y'all. I mean, at the end of the day, like, that is not reflective of even the demographics of the country at all. And in spite of that, in spite of how he's not doing well and polling well with Black voters outside of Indiana, but not even in South Bend. We went to South Bend, and there are Black activists in that area that have some major concerns and issues with him. And so I think that it's really important for us not to get caught up in the hype. Let's be clear now. A couple of months ago, folks were saying that Beto was like the new, he was born for this, right? And what happened? He's not even, he didn't even make it to Christmas. So my point is, you know, one, we can't get caught up in this, what the narrative is trying to push down our throats. Secondly, you know, what you hear is what you hear. The bottom line is, I'm glad that he's talking to Reverend Barber, but Black folks ain't just show up this weekend or 2 weeks ago, right? We've been here, and he's had Black people in his backyard that he hadn't quite made happy yet. And so, you know, part of it's kind of like my grandmother used to say, you know, take care of home first. And so I think he jumped out of the gate, did not take care of home first. Now, all of a sudden, everybody else is supposed to follow this frenzy. Black voters in particular are supposed to follow this frenzy of, well, look at how he's doing in Iowa. And then I think the third thing is, which we've got to really be honest about, is that Black voters are tired. We are looking at how this racist president is framing race and how we're seeing, I mean, I can't open up my iPhone or Twitter or Facebook without seeing where a white person has called the cops on a UPS worker or has called on a child trying to get their place. The bottom line is there's some critical issues dealing with race and racial equality that Pete Buttigieg has no history in working on. And that's why he's not doing well in the Black community. And you can't manufacture that and you can't create that overnight.
Man.
Esther, how was the weekend of Pete Buttigieg for you?
I did not think about him once, which was really wonderful, finally. I mean, I've written about Pete Buttigieg a lot, and I think I once described him as a candidate dreamed up by some DNC algorithm. Which I think is pretty accurate, right? You know, he's a flip-flopper. He's a candidate who thinks of the race as, you know, solely as numbers, right? What position can I take now? That's kind of the flavor of the month that will get me ahead in the polls.
Why do you say that?
I think you see that with some of the ways that he's now talking about Medicare for All, right? He previously said he supported it, said it was necessary, and now, you know, he's on the attack, right? Attacking Bernie Sanders, attacking Elizabeth Warren, you know, saying Medicare for All is not the solution we need, and really using that as a central aspect of his campaign.
When we see Pete Buttigieg in North Carolina, and I guess he spent like several hours in a church. It wasn't like one or two. It was like 5 hours meeting with people. You know, I interviewed Mayor Pete, and I found him, as many of the other candidates, very personable.
Right.
But I did find this thing, and I'm you know, if you've spent a lot of time reporting on him, is it authentic or not? Which was this, like, oh, I'm really listening to you.
Right.
Like, I'm really, really listening to you. And I said things to him like,
then I'm going to need him to listen to those Black voters in South Bend. How about that?
Yeah.
And perhaps he would know what Black voters in other places think. That's a good starting place. Like, take care of home.
Right. He's gotten so many kudos lately for listening to people, particularly Black people. I don't know if y'all read. There were two articles that came out on our sister site, The Root.
Yes.
We did.
Both of them.
Yeah. And he got so much praise for just calling the writer back and listening to him. And people were saying online, on Twitter and news articles, isn't it great for Pete to actually listen to this guy? And I'm like, what have you been doing for the past, you know, how many years you've been mayor of South Bend, which has a big Black population?
Right. Has the Black population, has their conditions, their material conditions change. If you're going to do this from the nation, I would think that on a smaller scale, you should have been able to demonstrate some changes in that. But aside from that, you know, in the midst of having a critique about Pete Buttigieg, I also want to lift up the fact that he is listening. I don't want to undermine that. And I don't want to say that I don't think that's a good thing. I think all politicians should do that, right? And I'm glad that he's doing that. And I'm going to give him kudos for doing that. The part that feels very disingenuous is that on one hand, you're saying, we're going to move forward. I'm going to be this progressive candidate, but then your positions, you are becoming increasingly more moderate and try to go into the moderate space. That's the part that I have problems with him.
Esther, I'm glad you brought up that Root piece because it definitely shook a lot of people. And this whole notion of him like, oh, he's listening to a Black man. Some people have
got too much praise for that. But I agree with you, Latasha, in the sense of, well, yeah, you should be listening. You should have been doing this a while ago. And why is this a quote unquote challenge? Because that's what he said in the debate.
And I welcome the challenge of connecting with Black voters in America who don't yet know me. And
but this kind of goes to the just something I want to talk about really briefly about how POC candidates are being viewed in this election cycle.
Without question. They're marginalized. You know,
let's be real. It does feel to me in this political cycle that if you're not talking about suburban white voters in the Midwest, then you're not really a viable candidate.
Absolutely. And that's time and time again. And I think even for the Buttigieg campaign to fall into that, I think that part is disrespectful. And the Black community and Black voters in particular are tired of that shit. Like, ultimately, every 3 weeks, it's like rounding Negroes up. Like, we're tired of that. If you are really serious about supporting the issues of Black folks, take care of the ones that you're closest with, i.e., can you listen to South Bend? Can you show us where you've made an agenda that literally has placed the Black voters in your district, the ones that you have been elected to serve, how have you served them? Help me understand that, and let's measure you by that. I'm not saying that you got to change the world, but ultimately, I think there is something that's very disingenuous of you not addressing those issues. It doesn't feel right.
Yeah.
Right. So you guys also mentioned a little racism in politics, and we kind of want to break it down a little bit, because guess what? There's plenty of racism in politics happening on the local level, and there are actually a couple of stories that broke the last couple of days during the break.
Well, you didn't have a break because you were busy working the whole time.
I literally, after Thanksgiving, had this wonderful meal with my family. They all went to go see Frozen 2, and then I stayed home, and I got this video from a Puerto Rican media creator. His name's Alvin Cueto de Jesus. He tweeted out a video about this Puerto Rican tennis player who got berated on a video in Sarasota at a private tennis club.
Why was he being berated?
Because they were speaking Spanish, according to the uncle. They were speaking Spanish before, and then Latino Rebels reported it out. We shared the video. We wrote a piece. We then find out a couple hours later that the man in the video was running for Sarasota City Commission. He's a Republican. His name is Martin Hyde. And if you go to his campaign page, it's all Trump all the time. So this is a clip from the video.
What?
Can we keep your mouth shut?
Mouth shut?
Yeah.
Calling the police, bro. We're calling the police. That's racism.
Call the chief. Call the chief police.
Yeah. That's racism, man.
Yeah.
How can you say something like that? Aren't you human? What? Aren't you human?
Yeah.
Aren't you human, man?
This is a private club. Get out.
Aren't you human?
I'm getting out. I'm getting fucking out. That's stupid. That's racism.
I know.
That's racism.
These things were thrown out of the club. I'm a member of the club. These kids are not.
You came in rude. You came in.
Michael wanted to throw out.
You're telling me to cut grass because I'm Hispanic.
You said cut some grass, man.
Yes.
So what?
Dude, it's a private club.
Wow. Call the chief of police. She knows me.
Yeah, exactly. So Hyde is a wealthy conservative politician in Sarasota. He denies being racist to the local reporters. And then over the weekend, he quit. He quit the race. But as of Monday morning, he's decided to reconsider his options and actually has issued like two apologies. And he went in the local paper, Maria, and said, you know, I'm running this campaign by myself. I mean, I don't have a Kellyanne Conway helping me out. So I'm starting to realize that maybe I should reconsider. And if you see the comments of him reconsidering, because now he's active again, you do see like, hey, they're playing the race card, you know, those Puerto Rican kids like acting, you know, causing trouble.
Right. So in another part of the country, Danielle Stella is one of five Republican candidates who's challenging Democratic Representative Ilhan Omar of Minnesota. And she tweeted out last week, quote, if it is proven that Representative Omar passed sensitive information to Iran, she should be tried for a hashtag treason and get hanged. So the tweet is about unsubstantiated allegations. And Omar has denied all of this. These are from a Canadian businessman who reportedly testified in a Florida court that Qatar is hiring all of these American agents, implicating people like Linda Sarsour and Jared Kushner. I know, crazy, right?
Oh, yeah.
This Canadian businessman said that they were recruited to advance Qatar's interests in the West. This testimony was originally reported by a Saudi state-controlled news channel, but of course, a bunch of right-wing news sites in the United States picked it up.
Of course.
So Stella, a Republican running against Omar, tweets this out, and then Twitter suspends all of her accounts. Esther, just like in 2016, we're already seeing blatant examples of how race is being weaponized by these candidates. I mean, this is some crazy shit that you've got to, like, be able to deconstruct. So what are your worries about how this is going to play out in 2020 with all of these progressive candidates of color who are running, who are being targeted, like, full frontally?
Right. I mean, this has been happening for a long time. I think we all understand now how social media has just kind of elevated and amplified those risks, right? I mean, I think the first thing is, you know, Twitter suspending this woman's accounts, sure, but why has it not done the same thing for so many other, you know...
like the president?
Right.
Exactly.
I mean, supposedly Twitter is adding this sort of warning to tweets by people like President Trump that are supposedly... could be read as incitements to violence or threats, but I haven't seen any sort of disclaimer on anything that he's posted, not even things that he's written directed at people like Representative Omar. And I mean, it's really troubling, right? I think the fact that social media companies like Facebook and Twitter aren't even doing the bare minimum, really, to signal that they take this seriously is really worrisome, right? I mean, Pinterest does more.
Damn.
Then Twitter and Facebook, right? You know, like you can't have these like wine moms reading like inflammatory content, I guess. But
I love the fact that you just mentioned Pinterest.
That's a great point.
Wine
Esther.
Moms. Yeah. Okay.
But it is really worrisome, right? Like people like Ilhan Omar have dealt with serious death threats. And she's reacted with so much grace and compassion towards people, you know, who have actually been convicted.
Right. No, and I worry, like, when I see Linda Sarsour, I mean, I'm just so worried for her because of this kind of bullshit, right, Julio?
Yeah.
Right. And then how do you think this is all going to play out? You have all these progressive women of color running again, you know, Omar, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, they're going to be back. And it's like, we're starting to see these examples of racism, which Esther says, you know, this has been going on. It seems more amplified. We just share two local examples. And it's only, like, to quote the Carpenters, we've only just begun.
Yes.
You know? So how is this all going to play out in 2020 with all these progressive candidates of color running?
I think we've got to do a better job with how we tell the story, how we take control of the narrative, because we've got to connect this to America has a history of doing this. Mm-hmm. Right after Reconstruction, there were 300 Black African-Americans that were elected in the state of Mississippi. A white mob over the course of a week went and killed 70 of them.
Wow.
Nobody knows this story. So on some level, we keep acting like, oh, wow, it's new and shocked. Why are we shocked? And what has happened is we've ignored how systemic racism has been in this country and how it takes a violent nature. And then when you've got a president, you know, who is the commander in chief, who is really basically giving the okay and creating the environment, you see what we're seeing. And so I think those progressives, we've got to make sure that we don't see 2020 as around just Trump. It's Democrats or Republicans. We literally got to see this as serious about not just saving democracy, but literally making this a safe environment to save our own lives. Secondly, I think that you can do something with their candidates that are running, send them money, help create, drown the voices out. At the end of the day, we can't act like, okay, we see these incidents and they're greater than us. No, the truth of the matter is, I think that they're acting a fool, not because we're losing, it's because we're winning. They can get over it. It's too late. America by 2050 is going to be majority minority. There's nothing they can do about that, right? And so I think we've got to stand in control around how we're going to shape the narrative, how we're going to push for legislation like hate speech, connect that with hate crime, and how we're going to beat their asses next year at the polling booth.
Well, how do you top that, Julio?
Well, I know. How do you top that? But I think the point that you guys raised about Trump is a really important point. This is going to be a strategy. It has always been a strategy, but now you have a presidential campaign that puts actual money that says it's okay.
Absolutely.
And so the Martin Hyde's of the world are going to reconsider to run for their local city council and run on a MAGA platform.
Absolutely.
That's what I mean. Maria, what do you think?
I think that it's crazy that, for example, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has 8 Republicans and 3 Democrats who are challenging her, that the Republican Party and social media has really zeroed in on targeting her as kind of the face of the enemy. And I was just thinking how Latinos and Latinas are like front and center of the campaign, whether, you know, build the wall through 45 or Republicans hating on AOC. And yet Latinos and Latinas still struggle to be seen, you know, at the center of the conversation. Hey, welcome back to In the Thick. I'm Maria Hinojosa with my co-host, Julio Ricardo Varela. We're joined by Esther Wang and Latasha Brown. Let's get back to the conversation. And now we're going to turn to our next topic, which is, you guys, the impeachment inquiry, which we're all addicted to, saturated, confused,
it was a nice break.
Overwhelmed. I mean, okay, this week the inquiry enters this new phase. So it's the Judiciary Committee. Hearings are scheduled for this Wednesday with legal experts to look at the historical and constitutional basis for impeachment. Now, this would be a time when the White House could have participated, but it said, hey, we're not even going. Plus, Trump's going to be in London for NATO anyway. The White House could participate in future hearings, but Congressman Gerald Nadler, a chairman of the Judiciary Committee, has given Trump and his attorneys until this Friday to decide if they're going to present witnesses or bring evidence in a public defense. And it's very possible that later this month, the House is going to actually vote on impeachment, and this will impact the upcoming election. I have questions, Latasha, of whether or not there's just too much of a rush to push this now. And what do you think about what might happen this week and the longer term impacts? What's your feeling on the ground about the impeachment?
One of the things that I think, well, we're hearing on it kind of in the national media, it's almost like you got to create an angle for the story to keep the story alive. Because the truth of the matter is people are really tired of the impeachment piece. Mm. Like people at this point, you got a side. You either know he's guilty and want him impeached, or you know he's guilty and you're still trying to protect him. So, you know, saying this is rushed or, you know, we should move forward. Like, to me, that's like a non-starter issue. That's just kind of like one of those spins, a media spin that we're hearing, particularly in the national media. Right.
Yeah.
And so, and particularly by Fox and others, I think that the process should move forward. Let's get on it. Let's get on the ground. Let's do what we got to do. You know, the question and the argument is around, well, what is the appropriate punishment? If it was up to me, the appropriate punishment is he should be in jail right now. You know, but given the circumstances and being realistic around what's happening, I think we need this process to move forward. We need to go on, wrap this up so we can actually handle the business, the people's business for 2020, get out there, do what we need to do, and really talk to people around why next election cycle is so critical. Part of what I think also happens in the media is that Trump has made himself, it's like a big blowfish, like this whole idea of, you know,
I need a moment.
Yeah, who, you know, I'm hearing these messages. Who can beat Trump? What are you talking about? When all of a sudden he became Superman and invincible, right? So it's almost like a false narrative, but what it does is it keeps the spin going and keeps the spin going. The bottom line is he's a wounded duck right now. And they know that. That's why they've got to lie and spin and not show up so they won't be accountable. The question is, how are progressives going to respond to this? And I think it doesn't be a matter of us getting caught up in the debate around it. It should be, how are we mobilizing and moving folks for next year so that we can ensure that we get this crazy dude and his folks out of office?
Esther, did you think about impeachment over the break, or was that also one thing that you were not thinking about? And if you did think about it, even in your nightmares or your dreams, what did you think about in terms of the next phase?
I mean, I watched the House Intelligence Committee hearings, and I feel like they turned my brain to cheese even more than it already was. I mean, I think I agree with Latasha, right? Like, people are already pretty set in what they believe, right?
Yeah.
Either they think Trump's a crook and they think he should be impeached, or they're so willing to engage in mental gymnastics to defend him that nothing is going to change what they think.
Right.
And I think the really important thing is, you know, we know that the House is probably going to vote to impeach him. The Senate's not going to do anything. And it's going to be about, can we get this man out of office? Right.
Yeah.
I think people care kind of abstractly about impeachment, right? Care about the fact that our president is this incredibly corrupt man, not just with the dealings with Ukraine, but with everything. Right. And I think our real opportunity is November 2020, and people understand that.
I don't know if you did see this other story that ProPublica broke last week. Speaking about the impeachment, someone who's been at the center of the inquiry, Gordon Sondland.
Mm,
so
right.
This came out. ProPublica reported that multiple women have come forward with sexual misconduct and retaliation allegations against Sondland, right? And this is from before he was the U.S. ambassador to the European Union. And Sondland has denied all the allegations.
So this reporting is just a reminder that in the backdrop of the impeachment inquiry in the election, in all of this, right, what we know is that we have a president with a number of sexual assault allegations against him, men in his allegation who are also facing these same kind of allegations, that there are courageous women with everything on the line who are continuing to come forward. And we see these big government proceedings that are becoming intertwined with hashtag Me Too.
Yeah. But in terms of the Me Too movement and you know, the impact in the impeachment around the 2020 election, Latasha, is this going to have any impact at all? Like, when you start thinking about these stories of sexual misconduct and sexual assault and allegations, are we just seeing more examples of, like, powerful men getting away with it?
I think to some women, this will make a difference. I do think, you know, the Me Too movement is one of the most powerful movements that we've seen in the last couple of years. And so, I mean, in the decade since in my lifetime, actually. And so I think that there is a growing sensitivity and frustration among women around sexual misconduct. You know, we've got a president who has 22, if I'm not mistaken, I think it's 22 allegations right now.
You're right, Latasha. It was 22 women so far that have come forward with formal allegations of sexual harassment or assault against President Trump.
Right. And so my grandmother used to say, birds of a feather flock together. And
when are you writing your grandmother's like books of wisdom?
I know, it's like, you
better write that book.
I'm telling you, all of my political strategy comes from my grandmother in Alabama.
Love it.
And so when you start looking at the breadcrumbs and you look at who he surrounded himself by, these are white men of power that really believe that they can do anything. And then on some level, they've been able to get away with it. I mean, for the most part, this man bought his seat. He bought being an ambassador. He gave him $1 billion.
Sondland.
And so he's an ambassador. And so he had no concern about these allegations by women when the person who hired him, the president in chief, he himself has all these allegations. So I really do think that what it raises is, I think it raises a particular opportunity for women. I think women will impact the 2020 election in a way that we've not seen. I think that women were the driver behind the change in the 2018 election and what happened in Congress. I think when you go to Alabama and see what happened in Alabama in 2017. So I think that trend will continue to go in 2020. And the more these stories come out, I think the more it's going to activate particularly young women to actually work against people like that and this president.
Esther, what do you think?
I did read that story. I think it was by ProPublica in partnership with the Portland Monthly. I mean, I think part of it was that it dropped, I think, what was it, the Friday, right?
Yeah.
Of last week, you know, right after Thanksgiving. But, you know, even then, it barely really made a blip, I think.
Right.
So many people, you know, don't know of these allegations, didn't read the story. And I actually think a lot of women voters in particular probably won't even care. I mean, Latasha, you brought up the good point, I think, about the Roy Moore election, right? Doug Jones and Roy Moore. I mean, I think it was something like 60% of white women Republicans voted for Roy Moore.
Right.
I think there's a way that these sorts of allegations, even though we're talking about it more, they're so public.
Yeah.
They're still kind of waved away as like, oh, this is just how the world is. Right. This is just business as usual. And I agree. I think more people are beginning to push back against that idea, rightfully. But I feel like we're in this moment where there's like a backlash to Me Too. Right.
Oh, yeah,
or
definitely.
There was this big media splash and people are shocked at the most horrendous cases, the most egregious cases. But the shit that is so common and happens all the time, people still kind of, you know, wave it away.
We're going to move on to our final segment, which we call Binge-Worthy, or what are you binging on in the popular culture?
So what's something that you've seen, a book, a Twitter feed, an Instagram, a movie, a Netflix? What is it? It doesn't have to be journalism. What is it that you've been binging on? And let's start with you, Latasha.
Prince. I am the number one Prince fan
Prince?
In the whole wide.
Mm.
Prince. Like the artist Prince. I love Prince. Y'all, like for 3 years, I followed Prince everywhere around the world.
Wow.
I went wherever he went. I saw 37 concerts. I went to Paisley Park. I don't
you
know how many times.
You seriously binged.
Wow.
Sure.
No, I am like a Prince binger. And it's interesting. I literally have been grieving since he left,
yeah.
since he died. Mm. My mother died a month after, so I couldn't listen to any of his music. And so there's this book called The Beautiful Ones, and then there's this Picturing Prince book that came out. And so over the weekend, that's all I've been binging on is pictures and content of Prince. And there's this new release of the 1999 album with some of the live recordings, the original live recordings. I am in the purple haze right now. Y'all need to understand that I have been doing a serious, serious Prince binge.
All right. I'm gonna join you in that purple
haze.
That's
so nice.
So, right.
That's I would also like to join.
All right, Esther, what have you been binging on?
Well, I've moved on from Love Island.
Oh,
and
yeah. I love the fact that
I wish
you,
I could say something different, but I will actually be honest and tell y'all what I actually binged on this weekend.
Yes.
Okay.
Which is the K-pop band BTS.
Oh, wait. You were binging because there was all this news.
Right,
this
right. K-pop
horrible...
as an industry is
oh, shit. It's like
pretty
fucking,
awful.
It's like imploding. If you didn't know, two K-pop stars were sentenced for like group raping and like drugging young women.
Yeah.
There have been two deaths
goodness.
Of young women K-pop stars. What the hell?
Yeah.
Okay, so,
I mean, K-pop as an industry, the way that it works is pretty widely known to be really abusive and exploitative.
Yeah.
I will say, except I think in the case of BTS. The one exception to the rule.
Don't touch my
please
BTS.
Please don't touch my wonderful boys.
Except BTS, those wonderful boys.
So, yeah, I recently started listening to them. I'd kind of been, you know, putting it off like, oh, I don't know about K-pop, yada, yada, yada. And then I watched this one video of theirs from 2016. It's called Blood, Sweat, and Tears. Yeah. Everyone should watch it. It's very good. And I literally bought a projector so I could lie in my bed at home in the dark. And just watch BTS and, you know, not think about impeachment, not think about the 2020 election.
Dude,
self-care,
just escape
for a little bit.
Self-care comes in all different forms.
And I'm now part of the BTS army, I guess.
Damn, I love that. All right, Julio, what's your binge?
The Morning Show on Apple TV with Steve Carell and Jennifer Aniston and Reese Witherspoon is looking into sort of like a morning show that has sexual allegations, obviously based on the Matt Lauer and NBC and the Today Show.
And to you at home, I understand how you must be feeling because I and the whole team here at The Morning Show are feeling the same way. Shock, disappointment, disbelief.
She's throwing me under the bus.
And while I don't know the details of the allegations, I understand that they were serious. And that keeping Mitch on was not an option.
I don't think we need to watch any more of this. Let's
Do
prep you for
your... Do not touch that remote.
I won't reveal too much. There's a backlash of it, and it's a little... It's not as, you know, it's more nuanced, and let's look at it from different angles, and every side has a story.
Oh, interesting, yeah.
So I think people should watch it.
I do think there's some backlash, but I also want to make sure that we don't fall in the same trap of centering what white women do. Right, or what white people do. And I raise that because I do think that there is a growing group of young activists, and particularly women of color, who I've seen be activated around sexual harassment and misconduct. I mean, how long it took to take R. Kelly down. My point is there is a surge
but one
of that's
the
happening on the ground.
What's very interesting, and before I ask Maria her binge-worthy, two of the characters are women and they're of color. They're black. Hmm. And there's a big turn in this. I'm not going to share much, but it kind of goes to your point, Latasha. Maria, what do you got?
So actually, my binges were inspired by In the Thick, which I kind of love.
Wow. Woo-hoo! So meta.
That's
so
all right.
One thing that I'm binging on was inspired by our show about domestic work and hearing more about the life and history of Harriet Tubman, who, you know, is one of my heroines. And, you know, there's a statue of her. I walk by her every day when I'm at the gym, going to the gym. So she's a very important part of my life. And there's a book that I saw. It's called She Came to Slay, The Life and Times of Harriet Tubman.
Wow.
By Erica Armstrong Dunbar. And I just bought it because I want to start reading, because Harriet Tubman led the Underground Railroad, but she was a washerwoman.
Right.
She was a woman who cared for people who were elderly and children. She cared for people. She was a quote-unquote domestic worker who happened to be a revolutionary American. And so,
that's right,
all my love to you, Harriet Tubman. You're my binge-worthy.
Woo-woo! Wow. I'm joining you on that one. I love Harriet.
I love it.
All right, you guys. That's it. Esther Wang, senior staff writer at Jezebel, and Latosha Brown, co-founder of Black Voters Matter and 2019 Harvard IOP Fellow. Thanks for the both of you for joining Julio and me on this episode of In the Thick. It was so good.
I was fun. I had a great time. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
I'm Maria Hinojosa.
And I'm Julio Regalo Varela.
Uno, dos, tres.
And remember, dear listener, please go to Apple Podcasts to rate and review us, because it really helps other people to find us. Remember that you can listen to In the Thick on so many platforms, Pandora, Spotify, wherever you decide to download us. Follow us on Twitter and on Instagram at In the Thick Show. Like us on Facebook and tell all of your friends and family to listen. In the Thick is produced by Nicole Rothwell, Noor Saudi, Luis Luna, and Lita Hallowell. Our audio engineers are Stephen LeBeau and Julia Caruso. The music you heard is courtesy of Nacional Kepta and ZZP Records. We'll see you next time. Thank you so much for listening, my dear listener. Hasta la próxima. Bye.
Ciao.
To be honest, the only political news I got over the weekend is when Joe Biden bit his wife's finger.
Oh,
at
damn.
The rally. I don't know if y'all saw that really lovely, touching moment of marital bliss.
No, what happened?
What happened? Was that like a Charlie bit my finger moment?
Charlie bit me.
Ah. So she was speaking at a rally in Iowa.
And when they cut to the President of the United States, you call your...
She was waving her hands, Joe Biden, Dr. Joe Biden.
Okay.
Joe Biden was standing right next to her. Her hand got within an inch of his mouth as she was waving frantically. And he just reached over and with this biggest, like, shit-eating grin on his face, just bit her finger. And
you mean
she acted like nothing happened. She
you mean
continued.
Like in a kind of sexy way?
I mean, I didn't want to think about that.
Oh,
but...
okay. But in a marital, like, sweet, not
I actually
not
thought
weird.
It was cute. Yeah.
Okay. Hey, oh, Latosha thought it was cute.
Okay, a little weird.
A little weird.
Okay.
It was a little
so
weird,
that was the only thing that penetrated my consciousness over the weekend.
What penetrated my consciousness was Kentucky Senator Kennedy, who was just like, well, no, I'm not being duped by the Russians. I am not being duped by the Russians.
That's pretty good.
It was all Ukraine. All right, I'm sorry. I'm back to you, Julio.
Your impression is
I want to say, like, Maria Hinojosa, just really, she'll be playing the ballet. She'll be playing Atlantic City later.
Now you stop.
The opinions expressed by the guests and contributors in this podcast are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of Futuro Media or its employees.